And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, a great nation where one of the greatest controversies, certainly one of the most enduring and permanent, involves taxation. Everybody knows you have to pay something in taxes. A government, a country, a society can't function without some money flowing to pay for the services, for the military, for the security that people need. But how much is too much? And how is the best way to tax people? And how did we go from being a country that resisted just pennies in excise taxes to a country that now accepts approaching 50% of what we earn going to government at various levels? It's certainly well above 40% today. There are lots and lots of shocking aspects to the whole history of taxation in the United States of America, and it's about time in this tax season, it's always tax season in the United States, to face the shocking truth about taxes.
'Cause I'm the tax man.
And the George Harrison song talks about the one-time 95% top marginal rate in Great Britain. We never got up quite that high, but we came awfully close. It's down again. There are a lot of Americans who think it would be better if we had that kind of rate of marginal taxation. There are also many Americans who think we need some kind of radical reform of the tax system, just erasing the entire mess of the Internal Revenue Service. Who started the Internal Revenue Service anyway? That and much more we will cover in this special broadcast. The hostility of Americans, particularly American founders, to taxation, very well known and very important to remember. Thomas Paine, the great revolutionary pamphleteer, the guy who in common sense made the strongest, best case that persuaded the colonists to go for independence, wrote in 1791, 8 years after the Revolutionary War was over, wrote a book called Rights of Man. And in the introduction to the second part of Rights of Man, he writes, "If from the more wretched parts of the old world we look at those which are in advanced stage of improvement, we still find the greedy hand of government thrusting itself into every corner and crevice of industry and grasping the spoil of the multitude. Invention is continually exercised to furnish new pretenses for revenues and taxation. It watches prosperity as its prey and permits none to escape without tribute." Eternally timely words. They're used by Amity Schles in her good book, The Greedy Hand, the title, of course, taken from Thomas Paine's quote, How Taxes Drive Americans Crazy and What to Do About It. The book was written almost 20 years ago, but it's still one of the better books about the modern system of taxation. But how did we go from the Constitution all the way there? Benjamin Franklin, who, of course, was at the Constitutional Convention, wrote not too long thereafter to a friend of his in France, "Our new Constitution is now established and has an appearance that promises permanency. But in this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes." Famous words. The Constitution has been permanent. And so have death and taxes, of course. But the constitutional fathers, as we've discussed, did try to make it very difficult to impose federal taxes. They had this mystifying prohibition on what was called direct taxation, but nobody knew for sure what exactly they meant. Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4, no capitation, meaning a head tax, or other direct tax shall be laid, unless in proportion, to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. So how are they supposed to fund the government? How exactly? Because with that prohibition, when they're talking about the census, what they're saying basically is you can't have a tax that is based upon how much property someone has. you can only have that tax based upon how many people live in a given state, which would create wildly different tax rates in all the different states if they tried to do that. So how'd they get around that? That was what Alexander Hamilton had to cope with when he took over as the first Treasury Secretary, and he was full of ideas. One of the big ideas that Hamilton cared about most was paying off the debts that the various colonies, the various states, had compiled during the Revolutionary War, because they had a tough time. Remember, under the old Congress, the Articles of Confederation, they had no right to tax for the federal government. What they did have the right to do was to call for money from the states. So to raise that money and to fund the debt and to pay the ongoing expenses of the new federal government, in 1789, right after they had swore Washington in as the first president and the Capitol had relocated to Philadelphia from New York, where it originally was, and they're in Philadelphia for 10 years. And right there, Alexander Hamilton immediately orders an import tariff on 30 different commodities. And this is very important to keep in mind, is that until the 16th Amendment in 1913, most of the funding of the federal government was done by tariffs, by money that would be collected from stuff that was imported into this country. And there were also excise taxes, and particularly at a time when imports weren't that heavy, the excise taxes were important. The tariff on the 30 commodities that Hamilton imposed averaged 8%, so it was a serious tax. And on all other goods, it was 5%, anything that was imported to the country. And in 1791, 2 years later, Hamilton was able to persuade Congress to impose an excise tax. Now, the excise tax was imposed on one of the most precious products then manufactured in the United States. The product was whiskey. Why was whiskey so important? Because for people who were growing grains, it was tough to transport it. No railroads, understand. So grains had to be transported with wagons. It was much easier to distill the grains into whiskey and to send big barrels of whiskey to market because it was much more efficient and much more portable. The entire economy of Western Pennsylvania, and not just Western Pennsylvania, but most of Appalachia, including parts of North Carolina and South Carolina and Virginia and Maryland, all of that economy was dependent upon whiskey production. So the excise tax on whiskey was very dangerous. The people in the Western frontier didn't like the federal government. It was far away. It was on the other side of the mountains. They particularly didn't like the idea of a tax on whiskey, and Hamilton knew that this was very important. Now, there's a whole conspiracy theory about what Hamilton was doing with the whiskey tax. The most complete book about what came to be known as the Whiskey Rebellion, which was a real rebellion with real armies and real battles and real casualties. It was our first civil war under the Constitution. But the book is by William Hoagland. He hates Hamilton. He really doesn't like him. And he believes that the first Secretary of the Treasury actually deliberately imposed the whiskey tax in order to provoke the poor, struggling Pennsylvania farmers and the farmers in elsewhere in Appalachia to resist the federal government so he could use a great big army to affirm federal power. Whether or not Hamilton's attempt to impose a whiskey tax was a deliberate provocation, it certainly provoked people on the frontier. They massed in revolutionary armies. They put up liberty poles. They organized conventions and congresses. What they were doing, and many of them veterans of the Revolutionary War, was they were doing precisely what they thought that the Sons of Liberty originally had done some 20 years earlier. They were resisting the whiskey tax the same way that American colonists had resisted the Stamp Act or the tea tax. But the results were very different. Why? We had a president named George Washington who ended up actually leading an army into battle. First president, only president to ever serve as actual commander in chief on the field of war. That and more coming up.
You're listening to a special broadcast of The Michael Medved Show, The Shocking Truth About Taxes. For more history programs, go to medvedhistorystore.com.
The music of the President's March, written in honor of our first president, George Washington, who was the first president to confront the prospect of civil war, of disunion, of secession, and a very serious armed resistance. This is a very special broadcast called The Shocking Truth About Taxes. And The Shocking Truth About Taxes involves the fact that we have not only had bitter political disputes over taxes over the years, but in the United States of America, we've also had actual warfare fought since the independence of our country over the issue of taxes. It was Shays Rebellion in Western Massachusetts that helped scare the Constitutional Convention into actually creating a system of government that would provide a stronger federal government and a stronger ability to actually tax people. Because one of the things that is a backdrop for everything that happens with the Whiskey Rebellion is the truly desperate need to get the United States on solid financial footing. They couldn't simply ignore the debts that the various states had compiled. Hamilton assumed the debts. The Jefferson made a deal, by the way, allowing Hamilton to assume all the debts for the federal government. The federal government would pay all the state debts. And in return, there was an agreement that after 10 years in Philadelphia, they'd move the capital to Virginia, basically, which is what they did. That's where Washington, D.C. is. It's carved a little bit out of Virginia, a little bit out of Maryland. It was moving to Jefferson's neck of the woods in any event. The point about the excise taxes that they imposed on whiskey, and it was 6 cents a gallon or 9 cents a gallon, this was considered to be horrible, not because people were so attached to whiskey, they were, but for the same reason that it was considered so horrible that the British were imposing special taxes on tea and on paper and on lead and on glass in the Revolutionary period, the problem was one of power. The farmers in Western Pennsylvania would never have voted to tax themselves on whiskey. Whiskey was important in their economy. It was the way that they could get the grain to market. It was also served as a kind of barter. There wasn't a lot of money in circulation, not money that people took seriously at all. And very often they would use these barrels of whiskey and as currency. You would trade a barrel of whiskey for anything else. So all of a sudden to tax that was to paralyze the economy. People were already poor. It was financially hard times on the frontier. And what's more, a lot of the frontiersmen had spent a lot of their time fighting Indians. And they felt that their sacrifices and their commitment in doing that already represented a contribution they made to the federal government over the mountains back in Philadelphia. This is an old Pennsylvania squabble, though there were whiskey rebels, as they were called, who were in the other states that have part of Appalachia in them. Ultimately, this rebellion got very serious. William Hoagland, in his book on the Whiskey Rebellion, describes the unhappy experience of one federal tax collector named Robert Johnson. And he writes, "As the gang applied hot, noxiously fuming tar to the shaved head and nude body of Robert Johnson, the sludge's oiliness was absorbed by Johnson's skin, and a scalding crust grabbed hair, holes and pores, and clung everywhere. When Johnson was sufficiently sticky, the gang applied poultry feathers, which, when shaken over a freshly tarred victim, or when he was made to lie down and roll in them, bonded with a slowly hardening blackness and could be removed only with time and effort. The triumphant gang took Johnson's horse and fled. Anguished by the scorn due all public enemies, the taxman was left alone in the dark forest." Part of the unpopularity of the whiskey tax was the fact that it seemed to favor larger distillers who had, if they had a lot of whiskey that they were paying taxes on, ended up paying at a lower rate. This seemed profoundly unfair. They sent petitions to the federal government. Hamilton and Washington said no go. And then the resistance began in earnest. They put up liberty poles. They had rallies and meetings. One meeting drew 7,000 people, which is a lot of people. It all centered around Pittsburgh. They had a convention in Pittsburgh where they actually called for breaking up the union and withdrawing from the federal government, actually withdrawing from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Part of the problem with the Whiskey Rebels is they had no brilliant leadership, no leadership really at all. These were very local bands, and they did come together for one battle. 600 armed men, many of them veterans of the Revolution, stormed the home of a tax collector. He had brought in federal troops to try to protect him. And this particular battle resulted in real casualties, two on one side, one on the side of the tax collector. And they actually drove him from the field because they didn't have anything like 600 people to protect the operations of government on the Western frontier. Washington held a cabinet meeting, and he asked his cabinet what he should do. And three of the four cabinet members said it was time to raise a major army and to go to the frontier to restore order. The Attorney General Edmund Randolph thought that was a mistake. He voted no. He voted for conciliation. Washington decided to do both. He sent representatives out to the frontier to try to negotiate with the Whiskey Rebels at the same time that they called for militia draftees, in effect, from various states, including New Jersey and Maryland and Pennsylvania, of course, Eastern Pennsylvania. Washington assembled an army of 13,000 men. And historian Paul Johnson points out this was a larger force than he ever commanded during the Revolution. And he actually met the force in toward Western Maryland, rode out from the presidency in uniform on a white horse, reviewed them, and then sent them on their way. They were commanded by the governor of Virginia, who was a hero of the American Revolution, a great cavalry commander, Light Horse Harry Lee. So this is a formidable force. Alexander Hamilton came along. He was also a hero of the Revolution. He came along to observe. He was deeply, deeply concerned that this whole experiment in federal government would fall apart unless they enforced the rules on the frontier. There was great fear that there would be major battles, but with 13,000 men, 12,940 to be precise, and commanded by General Lee, Governor Lee, with all of that going on, basically the rebellion melted away. People were arrested, people were tried, people were marched back to Philadelphia, some 400 miles. There were great hardships visited on the Whiskey Rebels. And what was established by the whole episode? The right of the federal government to tax people, even when they hated it. More about Lincoln's contribution and the shocking truth about taxes.
Thanks for listening, and subscribe today for our new Substack newsletter. That's Michael Medved's Context, placing today's big events in the unique perspective of our past and our future. Go to michaelmedved.substack.com.
The melody of Thomas Jefferson's campaign song from 1800, it's Jefferson and Liberty. Jefferson hated the whole episode of the Whiskey Rebellion and thought that the government had overreacted. It was one of the things that helped separate him from Hamilton and Washington. He was already headed very much in that direction. Washington, by suppressing the Whiskey Rebellion, gained greatly in popularity and stature. As much as we can get any indication, this was a politically, in 1794, very, very popular move, and it was a triumph. In fact, Washington said that Suppressing the Wistie Rebellion had drawn from the American people the support for law and government that marked their highest character. And Hamilton said the rebellion had strengthened the government, and it made national finance flourish. It clearly showed that the federal government, the new federal government and the Constitution, compared to the old government and the Articles of Confederation, was no paper tiger, particularly with a world-renowned military leader like George Washington as commander-in-chief. People weren't going to mess with them. The hardships that were visited upon the people when General Lee, and that General Lee, by the way, Light Horse Harry Lee, the father, not grandfather, father of Robert E. Lee, the great commander of the Confederacy. Ironic that he was marching at the head of an army to suppress a rebellion and to suppress an attempt to break apart the Union when his son so effectively, years later, led an effort at rebellion to break apart the Union. The Hoagland writes in his book about the Whiskey Rebellion that officers administered warrantless searches and seizures of property and subjected detainees to harsh conditions and terrorizing interrogations. Some victims were told they'd be hanged unless they gave false testimony against elected officials. Every adult male was required to sign an oath of loyalty to the government. Not surprisingly, most people complied. They took a few detainees and marched them 400 miles to the Capitol, poorly shod and clothed, the Capitol being Philadelphia, under the authority of an officer well known by his superiors for the pleasure he took in denigrating prisoners. On arrival, the suspects were paraded in the streets as victory trophies, then imprisoned under conditions that were even more extreme than normal. The threats of a terrible punishment were never fully carried out. Washington insisted upon a policy basically of mercy and amnesty for any of the people who had participated in the rebellion. And the truth of the matter is that it has come down to history by the designation Whiskey Rebellion, which was Hamilton's coinage. And it's a way of making light of it. The way that most people talk about this episode is, oh, it was all about whiskey. It wasn't. It was about power and the resentment, a deep resentment, of people that felt that they had no participation, no consent, that they had, in fact, taxation without representation. But this continued to be the way that government was funded. Excise taxes, taxes on various things. In 1796, there was a challenge to an excise tax that had been put on carriages. Carriages were usually used by people who had some money, so they thought they'd put a special tax on carriages. The Hylton case came down and it said, no, this is not a direct tax. This is okay. And this continued until the War of 1812, which was a disaster for the United States. And they had a tough time financing it. And in the War of 1812, a number of members of Congress, desperate to try to shore up the finances of the country, proposed America's first income tax. Now, this was based on the British model. The British in 1798, just 16 years before, had put their first income tax law onto the books. And the new income tax that they were proposing to fund the War of 1812 was pretty serious. It would be a tax on income of 10% on any income over £200. That was the British model. But it would have applied to people who were prosperous. This was deeply controversial. It was held up in Congress. Then the war ended, and the tax proposal went away, but only temporarily. It was another war that brought back the income tax and created the Internal Revenue Service. No, not World War I. It was the Civil War. Tell you how, coming up.
Thanks for listening and subscribe today for our new Substack newsletter. That's Michael Medved's Context, placing today's big events in the unique perspective of our past and our future. Go to michaelmedved.substack.com.
On the Michael Medved Show, this special broadcast, the shocking truth about taxes. And one truth about taxes that is undeniable is that in times of war, the American people are far more ready to consider and even to accept punishing taxes, even an income tax. The first income tax ever proposed in this country was introduced as part of a war measure during the War of 1812. It was never adopted because, fortunately, the war ended before then. And the nation continued to support itself, even through the Mexican War, tariffs, excise taxes. The various states had all kinds of means of taxing people. And, of course, most of the services for people were provided by the states, not the federal government. But all of a sudden, with the advent of the War for the Union, the need for major funding for the federal government became intense and extreme. And if you look at all of the reasons that the North actually won the Civil War after so much bloodshed and so much struggle, certainly economic superiority and superior economic management was a very big part of it. There were two big advantages that Lincoln started off with over Jefferson Davis. One was there was already a treasury. There was already established credit. The people were used to different countries and banks were used to lending money to the United States government. And that was a disadvantage. Is going into the Civil War, because of the Great Panic of 1857 and because of a lower tariff, the country, for the first time since the War of 1812, had run a deficit for 4 years in a row. And all of a sudden, here they have to fund this gigantic army and this huge military effort and a navy and all the rest of it. So Lincoln moved forward and pushed through, at the urging of his Treasury Secretary, Salmon P. Chase, the same guy who's generally credited with putting In God We Trust on our currency. Salmon P. Chase and Lincoln introduced and passed the very first income tax in American history.
You're listening to a special broadcast of The Michael Medved Show, The Shocking Truth About Taxes. Now it's time for Medved's Entertainment Minute.
Sean Penn stars as a veteran paramedic working for the New York Fire Department who tries to show the ropes to a newcomer and aspiring doctor who's overwhelmed by the blood, guts, and ugliness that are part of his new work in Asphalt City.
I know what you're thinking. Is it worth it?
It's the job.
We all work in the darkness. You don't gotta let it inside you.
But there's nothing but darkness in this brutal, deeply disturbing, and often very powerful film. It's based on a novel called Black Flies, with focus on wounds, cruelty, criminality, and sacrifice, and on deep sympathy for the people who work as emergency medical technicians. It's rated a very hard R, with nightmarishly vivid visions of suffering and death. The pitch-dark, monochromatic tone of this thriller limits the ambitious film's emotional impact. 2.5 stars for Asphalt City. It's tough to forget and also difficult to praise.
You're listening to a special broadcast of The Michael Medved Show, The Shocking Truth About Taxes. For more history programs, go to medvedhistorystore.com.
Salmon P. Chase and Lincoln introduced and passed the very first income tax in American history. And it was passed in 1861 as a war measure, a measure of necessity. And because the Democrats and the Southerners had walked out of the Congress, were not represented there, the Republicans had full control, And yes, you could say that it was a all-Republican administration, Republican House, Republican Senate, and Republican president who imposed the very first income tax. But the net result of all of this, and the taxation got much more intense as the war wore on, was a huge advantage for the Union. The Confederacy had to print currency that ended up being worthless. People know about Confederate currency. People used to collect the old Confederate dollars that weren't worth anything, and even major denominations. And terrible inflation and great economic chaos in the South. But the South raised, according to James B. McPherson, the great historian of the Civil War, in his book Battle Cry of Freedom, his estimate is that the South raised only 5 or 6% of its funds by actual taxation, where the Northern government, because of the income tax, was able to raise a full 21%. That, of course, led to more credit, so they were able to take out bonds and loans, and they sold bonds, of course, to ordinary people. But the first income tax came online in August 5th, 1861. And the reason for it was not just to raise money, it was to assure the financial community that they would get paid interest on their bonds. The Republican architects of the plan made it progressive. They had income taxes of 3% on annual incomes over $800. That would be today incomes of perhaps over $50,000. But 3% tax was accepted by most Americans. There was very little tax resistance. And Senator Fessenden of Maine, who was one of the authors of the tax bill, said that that this particular progressive tax, which fell more heavily on rich people, obviously, would combine with the regressive tariff that they collected, where obviously poor people have to pay more relative to their total resource on tariffs. He said, taking both measures together, I believe the burdens will be more equalized on all classes of the community. But that first tax bill of 1862 didn't do the trick, as 1861 bill didn't do the trick, which led to the 1862 Internal Revenue Act. And this is when the IRS was organized. Yeah, the Internal Revenue Service to pay for the Civil War. As McPherson writes, the Internal Revenue Act of 1862 taxed almost everything but the air Northerners breathed. It imposed sin taxes on liquor, tobacco, and playing cards, luxury taxes on carriages, yachts, billiard tables, jewelry, and other expensive items, taxes on patent medicines and newspaper advertisements, license taxes on almost every conceivable profession or service except the clergy, stamp taxes, taxes on the gross receipts of corporations, banks, insurance companies, and a tax on the dividends or interest they paid to investors, value-added taxes on manufactured goods and processed meats, an inheritance tax, and, ta-da, an income tax. The law also created the Bureau of Internal Revenue, which remained a permanent part of the federal government, even though most of these taxes, including the income tax, expired several years after the end of the war. The relationship of the American taxpayer to the government was never again the same. The progressive aspects of the earlier tax were expanded. The first $600 was exempted. There was 3% on incomes between $600 and $10,000, and 5% on incomes over $10,000. The first $1,000 of any legacy, of any inheritance, was exempt from the inheritance tax. The taxes went away after the Civil War. But the fact that this was associated with a heroic struggle to preserve the Union and associated with Abraham Lincoln itself made it easier for Republicans later, and it was Republicans who did it, to push for a change in the Constitution. About what? We'll talk about it coming up.
This is Michael Medved at michaelmedved.com for Town Hall. Based on 30 hours of intimate interviews, the superb new PBS documentary, Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in his own words, allows the Supreme Court justice to tell his remarkable story just as he had narrated to family members or close friends. His recollections come alive through expertly edited still photos and film footage showing his rise from desperate poverty in the segregated South to appointment to the nation's highest court. His confirmation process, nearly derailed by last-minute, clearly dubious charges by one-time aide Anita Hill, makes for riveting viewing, highlighting a much younger Joe Biden's bumbling role as chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. The two-hour film is rated PG-13 for some of the salacious aspects of Anita Hill's testimony, but viewers of all ages will feel inspired by the heartfelt patriotism and deep religious faith that allow Justice Thomas to transcend every obstacle. Created equal, a masterful piece of work, clearly counts among the year's best films. I'm Michael Medved.
And on this special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, The Shocking Truth About Taxes, people are always amazed to hear that we supported the tremendous growth of the United States of America. We supported even successful wars, many of them, without imposing an income tax, except for the brief period during the Civil War. And then there was an attempt to bring back the income tax in 1894. What happened was this, is we had been funding the entire government and all of its operations and all of our armies and everything else based on tariffs. Poor people and working people generally hated tariffs because it increased the price of goods. What you were asked to do is to pay more for any imported goods. Businessmen were fine with tariffs because it protected, by and large, what were called infant industries. Some of those industries weren't infant anymore, but it gave American industries an advantage over any foreign competition, obviously, with the American market. In 1894, in the midst of a terrible, terrible depression, President Cleveland, a Democrat, was president. The Democrats insurgents took over in Congress, lefties, populists, and others, and they pushed through a bill to lower tariffs, to cut the cost of things while we were going through this terrible depression, and to institute an income tax similar to what had existed during the Civil War. There were howls of protest. It was taken to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do this. It is a violation. It is a direct tax. Now, they didn't say every aspect of the income tax was unacceptable. What was unacceptable was taxing the profit that people made from property, in other words, for rents or from investments. And here's a dissent from Justice John Marshall Harlan. He wrote this in this famous Pollock decision. When, therefore, this court adjudges, as it does now adjudge, that Congress cannot impose a duty or tax upon personal property or upon income arising either from rents of real estate or from personal property, including invested personal property, bond stocks, and investments of all kinds, except by apportioning the sum so to be raised among the states according to population, this court practically decides that without an amendment of the Constitution, such property and incomes can never be made to contribute to the support of the national government. That's what the court had decided. But almost immediately, there were in fact calls to amend the Constitution. Those calls came instantly from Democrats and from populists, but later they were taken up and led by Republicans, including a conservative Republican president. Why? That is part of the story that Americans need to understand in coming to terms with the shocking truth about taxes in this greatest nation on God's green earth.